Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Say that.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and we're having fun because I really love these shows. I love when we do Bible questions with Jimmy Akin. It's always a lot of fun. You don't have to be Catholic to call. You don't have to be a believer of any kind. You don't have to know much about the Bible. Lots of people have questions about the Bible, and yours is welcome here. The Bible is a Catholic book. That's one of Jimmy's book among his other books. Look, I got a whole stack of them here. I can just tell you a whole bunch of Jimmy Akin books. The Fathers Know Best, Teaching with Authority, the very popular A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. That's just part of the Jimmy Akin library, so to speak. Tons of stuff available online. You can check out his webpage. You can check out his YouTube channel. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and every single line full. That's another thing that happens when we have Jimmy here. Every single line is, or all of the lines are often full. 888-318-7884 is the number as we go, and lines open up. You're welcome to call. And I want to get to Roman, because Roman's been waiting a while. Roman in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Roman, thank you for waiting through the last hour. Go ahead with your question.
I feel like there is a kind of circular reasoning kind of paradox in Christianity. I'm going to try my best to not be confusing. Basically, I was always taught that Lucifer is an angel of light, and as an angel, he has infused knowledge, and with that comes this knowledge that Christ will become man. Christ will become incarnate, and that's something he just could not like vibe with. He was like, absolutely not. I will not serve. And so then he falls, causes Adam and Eve to fall in Genesis, which causes Christ to become man later in the New Testament. But it's kind of like, well, Christ only becomes man because man falls, and man only falls because Lucifer tempted them and they fell. But then Lucifer only falls because Christ becomes man. And it kind of just seems to be like a circle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you'd like my perspective on that?
Yeah, I'm hoping I'm not the first person to ever ask this, but that's something I was kind of thinking about and trying to get an answer for.
Okay. Well, I guess I'd say a few things. The first one is the circularity that you're referring to is not intrinsic to Christianity. I think that you began your question, you can correct me on this, but I think you began your question by saying there seems to be a circularity in Christianity. Did I hear that right, or am I remembering that right?
That was pretty correct. Like this specific example, yes.
Yeah. Well, it's not intrinsic to Christianity. And the reason is that the argument you sketched out, although it does involve some theological views that are common, it only involves theological views or opinions, not things that Christianity requires. And so, like the idea that the reason the devil fell is because he learned Jesus was going to become man. That's one possible reason why the devil fell that's been proposed, but it's not the only one. There have been a lot of proposals for why the devil fell. In addition to that one, one of the early ones, and you may have heard of my podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where I've done a pair of episodes on an ancient Jewish Christian work called The Life of Adam and Eve. And in the life of Adam and Eve, it has a different theory for why the devil fell. In that version, and Sykelet will help me out here because he's helped me out on this one before, so he should remember what we covered before once I remind him.
Oh, good Lord.
The devil fell because God created man, not Jesus becoming man, but God created Adam, man, in God's image. And what do you do with the image of a god. Psychel, it over to you.
With
in the ancient world.
You worship it.
You worship it. And so God expected all of the angels to honor man as the image of God. And Satan thought, oh, man is this little puny worm. I'm not going to honor him. You know, I'm older than man. Why should I honor him? And that's what led the devil to fall. It wasn't Christ becoming man. It was the creation of man in the image of God. Another option that's been proposed is it didn't have anything to do with man or Christ. The devil just got uppity. He got above his station and wanted to be worshipped himself. So the truth is, we don't know why the devil fell. All of these are just theological proposals for why he might have fallen, but Scripture and tradition do not tell us the definitive answer. So I'm comfortable living with that ambiguity. I don't know why the devil fell. I can tell you what some of the proposed explanations are, but I have no clue which one of them is true. In fact, since I have a finite human intellect, I may not even be capable of understanding the reason that the devil fell, not in this life anyway. So whatever else you might say, the circularity that you've identified is not intrinsic to Christianity. The circularity only exists if you accept a series of different opinions, principally the one about why the devil fell. And that's just an opinion. It's speculation. However, there's a second issue with the circularity of the argument you mentioned. Now, it may be true that there is a circle in the sense that if you assume the devil fell because he knew Christ was going to become man, and if Christ only became man because of the fall, and if man fell because the devil tempted him, then there is a circle there involving the devil, Christ, and man. But that doesn't mean it is a logical problem, because, you know, there are circles that exist in history. I mean, I could say bring over a pizza and give it to Cy Kellett, and Cy Kellett might give some of that pizza to his wife Missy, and Missy might give some of that pizza to me. But even though we've got a circle involving me, Cy Kellett, and Missy, that's not a logical problem. And in the same way, the circle that you proposed wouldn't be a logical problem either. One way of illustrating that is by pointing to a theory that was proposed by Blessed John Duns Scotus. He was a medieval theologian. He lived a little bit after the time of St. Thomas Aquinas, and he proposed that Christ would have become human, would have incarnated as man, even if man had never fallen. And so the idea that you'll notice that in the circle that I sketched, where I said, and because I was trying to nudge it in the direction of a circle that would actually have a problem, is if Christ became man only because of man's fall, you know, well, then you would have something more of a circle. But John Duns Scotus's opinion is respected. It's not the official teaching of the church, so it's just a theological opinion too. But his opinion that Christ would have become man even if man had not fallen illustrates that the circle you're talking about doesn't involve a logical contradiction, because on John Duns Scotus's theory, the devil may have just learned Christ is going to become man and I'm not down with that, and he rebelled and fell. And then kind of on the side, he corrupted man, and man fell too. But even if he hadn't done that, the causal logic would still work. If man had never fallen, then if the devil learned Christ is going to incarnate as man, and that causes the devil to fall, well, there's no logical contradiction here. So I would say that the circularity, number one, is not intrinsic to Christianity because it's based on theological opinion rather than things that the Christian faith actually requires. And even if you make those assumptions, the assumption that those opinions are true, it still doesn't generate a logical contradiction, because not every circle involves a logical contradiction. And if John Duns Scotus is correct, then the devil could have fallen because God had determined Christ was going to become man whether or not man fell. So that's what I'd have to say about that. Is that helpful, Roman?
Yes, actually, very, very much so. I really appreciate that. I was kind of always taught this is why the devil fell. And I get it was never, you know, doctrine or dogma, but I never heard another reason. So yes, mm-hmm. very much so. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Roman, God bless you. Thanks for starting us off this hour. That'll bring us right to the break. We'll be right back with more of your Bible questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
St. Carlo Acutis shared a dream in which Sister Lucia appeared to him, saying the first Saturday devotion could change the destiny of the world. The Blue Army of Our Lady of Fatima invites you to practice this devotion. Join a First Saturday virtual pilgrimage beginning December 6th. Experience spiritual meditations while traveling virtually through Portugal and Spain to 12 sacred sites tied to the Fatima story. Track your journey with a passport and stamps. Visit BlueArmy.com and select First Saturday Pilgrimage to learn more. Sponsored by Our Lady's Blue Army.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Pope Francis tells us, becoming a priest or a man or woman religious is not primarily our own decision. Rather, it's the response to a call of love. Do you feel as if God may be calling you to religious life? If so, contact a religious order faithful to the magisterium or your diocesan vocation. For information on the priesthood or religious life, visit EWTN.com/religious life today.
Jimmy Akin, our guest on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin podcast is Jimmy's other podcast. And you're like, wait a second, I've heard Jimmy on this podcast. Yeah, Jimmy does a lot of visiting on podcasts and helping people on their podcasts. But the other Jimmy Akin podcast is called, wait for it, the Jimmy Akin podcast. And you can get that wherever you get your podcasts. So you can get it at Jimmy Akin's channel. What dropped on Monday on the Jimmy Akin podcast?
This last Monday, I released a debate that I had on Joe Schmid's channel. He wanted to know if I would debate a skeptical philosopher named James Fodor about the question of whether Jesus rose from the dead. And so we had a cordial discussion. We both presented opening statements, and then we basically cross-examined each other for the rest of the two-hour debate. And it's very interesting. Fodor takes a different approach to arguing that Jesus did not rise from the dead than many people do, and I took a different approach than many people do in defending the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. And I always leave the evaluation of debates to others. But I can say that many people in the comments section after watching the video thought I was calm and logical, and many people thought that James Fodor was less calm and more a little more rattled, because he had configured his arguments for one set of responses and I used different ones. But that was the opinion of some. You can watch it and or listen to it and make your own evaluations.
Jimmy Akin podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts or at his YouTube channel, the Jimmy Akin channel on YouTube. Our next caller with Bible questions for Jimmy this hour. Sarah is in Pooler, Georgia, watching on YouTube. Glad to have you here, Sarah. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, my gosh. Can y'all hear me?
Oh, my gosh. So clearly. You are like the best caller today, Sarah. You're so clear.
I'm so excited to talk to you and Jimmy Akin. This is awesome.
Well, it's awesome for us, too. Go ahead.
Oh, my goodness. So, my question is about the second letter of John. In the first line, it talks about the elect lady. And a BYU researcher has said he figured out who this lady is. And so I pulled out my Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, and I looked in there, and it says in there that the elect lady is probably a church in Asia or something. And wasn't it Scott Hahn who worked on that Bible?
He was one of the people involved, yes. He wasn't the only one, but yes.
I'm wondering if somebody needs to tell him it needs to be revised already, because this guy says he knows who it is.
Well, just because a professor at a university says they've determined something doesn't prove that they're right. And so I wouldn't, knowing just what you've said so far, I don't have any evidence that would support a revision.
I skipped over myself. I'm so excited. He's saying it's Electa, an early Christian woman who Clement of Alexandria said was a Babylonian woman. And he said it because he retranslated the Greek. And I guess I'm just confused because he said that scribes misscrobe it. And I'm pretty sure us OG Christians were the scribes.
And okay, so that's his argument?
Pretty much. And that he translated it to be this woman named Electa.
Okay, well, first off, compliments on that Old English past tense back formation of from the noun scribe as scrobe.
Nice.
That's really impressive. English has lost the Old English middle vowel shift. So people today tend to just tack ed onto the end of a word, instead of saying the past, so that the past tense of cook is cooked. But in older English, we, instead of tacking on ed, what we did was change the vowel in the middle, which is why run in the past tense is ran, and why swim in the past tense is swam, and things like that. So taking scribe, instead of making that scribed, making it scrobe, high points.
Nice.
I appreciate your knowledge of ancient English morphology. Having said that, I would have to see this guy's argument. So I understand the claim that he's apparently made, that there was a woman named Eclecta whose name has been mistranslated as the elect lady or the chosen lady. But that doesn't prove he's right. I'd have to see evidence for that. The idea that you could translate this as a proper name, Eclecta, is not new. Scholars have been aware of that for ever. I mean, the Greek word eklektos just means chosen or elect, and eklekta is the feminine form of chosen or elect. So if there were people in the ancient world who were named Eclecta, well, that's an option. And I've read biblical commentaries where the author, mentions this as a possibility, that it could be a proper name. But most scholars have concluded that that's not the case, which is why it's not translated as a proper name in typical Bibles. Almost every Bible, in fact, every Bible I'm aware of, I'd have to do research to see if this bears out, but every Bible I'm aware of at the moment translates it as like the chosen lady or the elect lady or something like that. And this is because there is more than one passage in the New Testament that seems to refer to a local church as a chosen woman. And based on the totality of the evidence, most scholars have been convinced that that's the case here, that this is not a proper name, but a symbol of a local Christian community, a local church. Now, that's not proven beyond argument. So if this scholar you're mentioning has a good argument, I'd love to see it. But what I can say at present is most scholars have concluded that that is not the case, that the balance of the evidence points in the other direction. And so I wouldn't see a basis for insisting on a revision in the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible. One of the things about study Bibles is, you know, because they tend to be one volume, there is only a limited number of interpretations you can mention in a study Bible, because if you mention them all, it wouldn't fit in a single volume. It would be a multi-volume set. That's like why if you look at commentaries on the Bible, they're frequently, you know, dozens of volumes long. And a study Bible that mentioned every interpretive possibility and the arguments for it would have to be just as long. It would cease to be a Bible and would become a commentary set. So in the process of making a study Bible, you have to leave out lots of options. That's why I don't personally use study Bibles, because I want to see all the options. That's why I go directly to commentary sets. I would simply say, well, the authors of the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, I don't know who wrote this particular passage, whether it was Scott Hahn or I think it was Curtis Mitch was the other one, or who it may have been. I would assume that they looked at the evidence regarding this verse and said, you know, the personal name theory is out there, but it's not well supported enough by the data to mention it. So for space-saving reasons, they left it out. That would be my guess, and I wouldn't see, at least based on my present knowledge, I wouldn't see a reason to say, hey, let's change it, but I'd love to know the guy's argument.
Okay, Sarah?
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, no shade to Scott Hahn. I mean, he's great. I was just wondering. I appreciate it so much.
Sure.
Well, it was very, very nice to talk with you. I was going to try to do a past tense of talk, but that was in the Middle English, but I can't do it, Sarah. You're way better than me. Hang on. We'll send you one of Jimmy's books if you want. Any book that we've got in the Catholic Answers catalog from Jimmy Akin, I'd love to send it to you. Thank you for a very nice call, and I hope you'll be a regular caller, Sarah. Thank you. The number here, 888-318-7884, and it's your Bible questions for Jimmy Akin. Jacob is in Arkansas listening on the Catholic Answers app. Hi, Jacob. You got a question for Jimmy?
Yes. Can you hear me well?
Very well.
All right. My last semester at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, I had the privilege of taking a history of Christianity class with Dr. Michael McCoy. I asked him if he knew who you were, Jimmy, and he said that he wasn't familiar with you. However,
it's mutual. I don't know him either.
Okay. In that class, we covered the synoptic problem a whole lot. And he taught us both the inspiration from Mark as well as the Q source. But then in your Bible Codex episode, you expressed your skepticism of the Q or well-end source. I just wanted to know your opinion on that and what your reasoning behind it is.
Okay, so first I should, for folks who may not be familiar, I should explain what the Q source is alleged to be. And I'm sure I'll talk about this more in a future episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast. But basically, in the 20th century, it was proposed that there is a lost document that was used both by Matthew and Luke. And this lost document came to be called Q. The reasons for that are a little unclear. Sometimes you'll hear, and this is the most common claim, is that that scholars decided to call the document Q after the German word Quelle, which means source. So they got super creative and decided to call the source document source, or Q for short. There's actually a little debate about, is that the reason it got named Q? But that's a separate issue. The basic material that Q is thought to have contained is a set of approximately 235 verses that are in Matthew and Luke that are not paralleled in Mark. So there are certain stories that Matthew and Luke both have that Mark does not. And so to explain where did Matthew and Luke get these stories, in the early 20th century, it was proposed that they got them from this lost source, which was then dubbed Q. And that is a possibility. I don't rule it out, but as something that's possible, but I'm personally skeptical of it. And there are several reasons I'm skeptical of it. The first one is a central part of the argument for Q assumes that Matthew and Luke did not know each other, that they worked independently of each other. They both independently found Mark and independently decided to write their own gospels, and then they both wrote them, but Matthew did not know Luke, and Luke did not know Matthew. However, that ain't the only option, so I'll tell you more after the break.
Jacob, I hope that you can hang on. I'd love to get let you continue with if you have any follow-up questions for Jimmy. And I also think I'm probably going to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. But you got to hang on for that. It's Bible Questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers. And now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Well, look at that. Some lines have opened up. Perfect time if you've got a Bible question, whether you're a Bible expert or a complete Bible neophyte. Look that one up. There's a word for you. If you're a complete Bible neophyte, anyone can call 888-318-7884. We just love talking about the Bible. I just love it when Jimmy Akin talks with people about the Bible. I've said it many times. This is one of my favorite shows that we do here on Catholic Answers Live.
Yeah. So good. I do it, Sykelet, so you don't have to.
Well, it would not be as good if I did it. It would be fun, but I don't think it would be as good. Jacob in Arkansas wants to know about the Q source and the evidence for it. Jimmy, you were in the midst of an answer.
Yeah, though. Actually, though, since we just had a break, Jacob, what part of Arkansas are you in? I'm just curious because I'm in Arkansas, too.
I'm living in Stuttgart right now. I did 3 years at Fayetteville, and my parents live in Clarksville.
Okay. Just curious. Always nice to run into a fellow Arkansan. So, in terms of Q, there are these approximately 235 verses in Matthew and Luke that are not paralleled in Mark, and they could have had a common source. And if that source was written, we could call it Q, and that would all be fine with me. But the assumption or the belief in Q is based on the assumption that Matthew and Luke worked independently of each other and did not know each other. And that's an assumption that hasn't been demonstrated. If Matthew knew Luke or if Luke knew Matthew, then we have an explanation for where these verses could have come from. If Matthew supplemented Mark and then Luke read Matthew, he could have pulled these 235 verses from Matthew. And that's a position known as the Farrar hypothesis. On the other hand, if Luke expanded Mark and then Matthew wrote last, he could have pulled the 235 verses from Luke. That's a position known as the Vilke hypothesis. And personally, the Vilke hypothesis is the one I think is most probable given the evidence. But there are various reasons to doubt the existence of Q. The first one is we don't have it. And if we don't have it, why would we not have, you know, an early primitive source of Jesus' sayings? Now, there are possible answers to this question. One of the answers that is commonly accepted by those who believe in Q is that, well, basically all of Q ended up in Matthew and Luke. That those 235 verses, that essentially is Q. I mean, maybe there were a few little extra verses, but basically all of Q got incorporated into Matthew and Luke, so there was no reason to keep copying Q independently because it was all already there. So that's one possible explanation for Q. But we don't have any references to Q. We have references to various gospels that we don't have, but we can't identify any of them with confidence as Q. So it's a very speculative source. That's one factor that needs to be considered. Another factor is it doesn't look like any other kind of literature that is known to have existed in the early Christian community. You sometimes hear Q described as a sayings source because a lot of the 235 verses involve sayings of Jesus. And I forget if it was the late 19th or the early 20th century, we found the Gospel of Thomas, which just is a sayings collection. And so that kind of boosted the fortunes of Q in that at least we had a sayings collection. It's clearly not Q, but you could show, well, some early Christians had sayings collections. And so that made it more possible that there was an early sayings collection that could have been Q. The problem is when you actually look at the 235 verses, it isn't just a sayings collection. It also includes narrative material. There's material in it, for example, about John the Baptist. And so this wasn't a sayings collection, but it also wasn't a biography. And if you look at the whole thing, it doesn't seem to make sense in terms of what it includes or doesn't include. It doesn't fit into a known genre like here's a biography of Jesus, that's what a gospel is, or here's a collection of the teachings of Jesus, like Thomas purports to be. It's kind of a hybrid in the middle. And so as a result, there are significant reasons to doubt Q. Now, I've written about some of this at my website, jimmyakin.com. Due to a search engine issue, you may have some difficulty finding some of that. But there's a book I would recommend. It's by Mark Goodacre. His name is spelled G-O-O-D-A-C-R-E. I think it's either R-E or E-R, but it's Goodacre. And the book is called Question in Q. And he goes through a substantial number of considerations that I think cast very substantial doubt on the existence of Q. I think the I think it probably did not exist. If it did, it's fine with me, but I think it's probably not the case. And I would recommend Mark Goodacre's book, Question in Q. Now, I'll mention I substantially agree with Mark. I have a lot of similar views to his, but I will mention one that I disagree with him on. He's a supporter of the Farrar hypothesis that said Luke wrote last, whereas I tend to be a supporter of the Vilke hypothesis that Matthew wrote last. But other than that, I also tend to think the Gospels were written earlier than Mark does. But in terms of the arguments he marshals against Q, I think they're bang on. So I'd recommend that to you for more information.
And Jacob, I asked for calls and now all the lines are full. So I'm going to leave that there for you. I hope that was helpful. And I will send you a copy, if you'd like it, of Jimmy Akin's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Just give us an address there in Arkansas and we will send it off to you. I'm going to go to Houston, Texas now, where Dan is listening on 1430 AM. Awful good to have you here, Dan. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm going to make this quick, and then I'm going to hang up and listen to the reply on the radio.
Okay, Dan.
I am curious. I've got family members and other people that have told me, well, how could God be God? Because the ancient Israelites, the Hebrews, were told to wipe out these people, you know, the Philistines or Amorites, Hittites or whoever. And, you know, Elijah killed all the prophets of Baal, and you know, the Israelites were commanded to kill every man, woman, and child, and even the livestock and the animals and such. It's like, well, how could God be God if he's going to order that kind of merciless killing? And I see that as being a prefigurement, and I think it's a bit of a stretch, and that's what I'd like you to comment on, if it's too big a stretch, that as a Christian, you know, a lot of what we see in the Old Testament is prefigurements of the Christian life, if you will, you know, the Red Sea and baptism and all that. So what I'm wondering is it a bit of a stretch to think of God commanding the ancient Hebrews to wipe out an entire pagan population, according to the words of the Old Testament, to wipe out an entire pagan population, kind of compared to, well, the sin that is in your life, you need to wipe out that sin completely. Have nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. Every vestige of sin needs to be exterminated from your life. You know, can be holy as your Father in heaven is holy. Now, I'm wondering, is that a bit of a stretch to see that as a prefigurement of the Christian life in that sense? I'm going to hang up and listen to your reply on the radio. Thanks.
Okay. So, whether or not it's a stretch, in your words, depends on how you take the question. If you mean, can you see in these passages in the Old Testament a spiritual message that Christians need to have nothing to do with sin and need to wipe out sin from their lives? Well, that's not a stretch at all. In fact, there were church fathers who looked at these passages and interpreted them in exactly that way, that these passages teach us Christians a spiritual message that we need to wipe out sin and get rid of it. However, that only addresses what's called the spiritual sense of the text. The spiritual sense of the text goes beyond what's known as the literal sense of the text. The literal sense of the text is what the human author was trying to communicate to his audience. And it's limited by the knowledge that the human author has of his subject matter. The spiritual sense is broader, though, because it doesn't depend on the human author's knowledge. It depends on God's knowledge, and God is omniscient. So he knows everything. He knows that in the future there are going to be these people called Christians, and he can have the human author structure the text in a way that will be meaningful to future Christians, even though the human author writing before the time of Christ would not have been aware of these added messages that are part of the spiritual sense of the text. So can you take the spiritual sense of the text in the way you mentioned, Dan? Absolutely. Christians can get that as a spiritual message from the text, but it doesn't answer the question of what's the literal meaning of the text. What did it literally mean in the original time when it was written? What was the human author trying to communicate to his audience? And there, the proposal that you made would be a stretch, because it is unlikely that the human author didn't envision some kind of killing going on. So what do the passages mean? Well, there are different interpretations of them, but they basically fall into two categories. The first category says these passages are absolutely literal in the sense that, yes, God commanded them to kill all of these people. And it was okay to do that because God is the author of life. So it's up to him. I mean, everything we have, including life, is a gift from God. So it's up to God to determine how much of that gift we get. And it's up to God to determine what are the circumstances in which our life ends. I mean, everyone's life is going to end sometime. And so it's up to God to make that determination. And if he determines that that these people need to be killed for at this time, well, then that's okay. God can make that decision. So that's one interpretation or one category of interpretations. And that one has historically been common. St. Thomas Aquinas, for example, would have supported that. But not everyone, especially in recent times, has found that convincing. And so some scholars have taken another look at these texts and they've proposed another interpretation. The other interpretation says these passages are not meant to be taken literally. If you look at them, they're all written long after the time they're describing. They're not like contemporary accounts. They're written centuries later, talking about an earlier period when the Israelites were threatened by paganism. And they're hyperbolic, because that means they exaggerate to make a point. I mean, it'll say things like, God said, completely wipe these people out. And then the text will say, and they completely wiped them out. And then a little bit later, the text will mention, oh, some of these people were still alive. Even though literally it said they got completely wiped out earlier, it's clear they really weren't completely wiped out earlier. So it looks like the text is used in hyperbole. Like when we say, you know, this football team slaughtered this other football team, we don't mean that literally. They didn't literally kill everybody in the other football team. And in the same way, when you have, it's like, yeah, the Israelites slaughtered the Amalekites, it doesn't mean they literally did so. So given that they use these texts use hyperbole, and that they were written long after the events that they describe, it's quite possible, and this is actually similar to what you proposed, Dan, it's quite possible that they were teaching a message. It's just a little bit different. It's not that Christians need to eliminate sin from their lives and have nothing to do with it. It's that the ancient Israelites needed to eliminate paganism from their lives and have nothing to do with paganism. And that's which is a subspecies of sin. But that's, according to this second school of thought, essentially what these passages are trying to communicate, that you Israelites, you need to have nothing to do with sin and just wipe it out of your lives. And it doesn't literally mean kill all pagans. So those are a couple of schools of thought on how these passages can be taken. But when it comes to the literal sense of the text, of what the human author was trying to communicate, I think it's probably one of those latter two. And personally, I lean towards the just get rid of paganism interpretation, and that these were never meant as totally literal commands to just wipe these people completely out.
And I am going to leave it there. I hope that that answer was helpful to you, but we have to take a break. Right back with more Bible questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live. The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because it is the food of the saints that we receive. And for the saints, they understood rightly that the time after Holy Communion, that those moments are the most precious moments of our lives.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Let's see if we can get to everybody who's on the line. We've got Bible questions for Jimmy Akin. And off we go to Efren in Palm Harbor, Florida, watching on YouTube. Efren, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
Thank you, Jimmy, for all your knowledge and that you share with all the church. I wanted to ask about the Targum Neophiti, which is a translation in Aramaic for the Pentateuch. How incredible is it? What's your opinion, and what does the church say about it? And what is the difference between that and what we have currently in the five first books of the Bible? Thank you.
Okay, well, first let's do the easy question. What does the church teach about it? Nothing. The church does not have teachings on particular manuscripts of parts of the Bible, whether they're in Aramaic, like the Targumim, or whether they're in some other language. The church leaves all of that manuscript analysis to scholars. And so the church doesn't have any teachings on it. It's going to just defer to scholars and what they've determined. So that was one of the questions you asked. In terms of scholarly opinion on it, well, it's a source that contains an Aramaic translation of the first five books of the Bible, and that can be valuable to help, you know, determine the history and original readings of various passages in the first five books of the Bible. Not by itself, but in conjunction with other manuscript traditions, giving pride of place to those that are actually in Hebrew, which is the language that the first five books of the Bible were originally written in. So any translation, whether into Greek like the Septuagint or into Aramaic like the Targumim, is not going to be as likely. It's going to contain more risk of change and distortion compared to the original Hebrew. That's a little bit of an oversimplification, but basically, if you had to choose and knew nothing else, you would want to go with what a Hebrew manuscript says over what a Greek or Aramaic manuscript says for these books. But in some cases, you can build arguments that, yeah, the Hebrew that we've got in, say, the Masoretic text from the Middle Ages, it doesn't look original. It looks like this other reading that we've got in Greek or Aramaic is more likely the original. And sorting through the questions about what's the original reading for every passage in the Bible is what Bible scholars do, or I should say there are Bible scholars who do that, and they produce what are known as critical editions of various texts. Whenever you see something labeled a critical edition, that means it incorporates material from multiple different copies, sometimes in different languages, and tries to figure out what the original text said. So that's what a critical edition is. And there are critical editions of both the Old and the New Testament. Now, these critical editions are based on scholarly opinion. They're not infallible, but they and they're revised from time to time based on new discoveries and new arguments. But they are, in general, the best versions of the original text that scholars have been able to recover. And Targum Neophiti is one of the texts that scholars can consider in formulating a critical edition. In terms of your last question, how is it different than other versions of the Torah? And I assume by that you would mean that are found in a modern, you know, Hebrew Bible or in the Masoretic text or something like that. That's a question I would frankly have to go research, because any time you translate a text from one language into another, there's going to be a lot of places where the translation is debatable. And there will be manuscript variants, and in a work the size of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, there will be lots of little bitty differences. Now, these differences will not in the main affect anything substantial, but there are going to be a lot of them, and I can't easily summarize what they would be. I'd have to go and do research to try to pin them all down, because frankly, I tend to, just like the church, I tend to defer to the scholars who have reconstructed the critical editions, and I normally don't have reason to dig back into the reasoning for why did they go with this reading rather than this other reading. Sometimes I do that, but that kind of scholarship is not my thing. I tend to focus on what does this text mean, and I only dig into, is this the original reading, if there's a special reason to.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to keep going, Ephraim, because I want to try to get as many on as I can before we have to let Jimmy go and let me go. And Keith is in Northern Virginia. Keith, go
ahead. Sorry, I'll even let your people go.
Let my people go, Jimmy. That's my prayer. All right. Go ahead, Keith, with your question.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Thanks for taking my call. Grew up Lutheran, went to Concordia Lutheran Seminary for a few years. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about Matthew 16:18 and the Peter being the rock. And we were always taught that the words used was when Christ said, "Upon this I will build my church." The word "this" versus the word "you," I will build mm-hmm. my church. So we were always mm-hmm. taught that the word "this" was referring to the fact of Peter's faith and understanding that was revealed to him, you know, by God. Kind of basically God opens his eyes to the actual fulfillment of Christ being who he really is. And mm-hmm. so I'm curious how the word "upon this" versus "upon you, Peter, I will build my church." Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I have the sense of what you're asking, but I don't know who taught you this, but they're doing surgery on the text, and what they're envisioning. And we're short on time, so I'm going to have to say it really quick. I'm going to have to be blunt. This is a bad argument because it would destroy what Jesus is saying here. Jesus says, "On this, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." Now, it would destroy what Jesus says if Jesus said, "I tell you, you are Peter, and on you, Peter, I build my church. I will build my church." That would destroy the poetry of what Jesus is saying. It would eliminate the reference to Peter as this rock on which the church is built. What Jesus is doing is he's saying, "Look, you're Peter, and on this poetic image of you as the rock, I'm going to build my church. There's a lot more to say about this, but I don't have time to say it. So what I'll suggest is go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. And in the search bar for my channel, not all of YouTube, type in, is St. Peter really the rock? Or just type in Jimmy Akin podcast episode 36. And that's 3-6. And I go through the argument showing why Peter is the rock in much more detail than I have time to right now.
I'm sorry I got on so late, Keith. But in addition to what Jimmy just suggested, I'll also send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, if you'll just give us an address. Jimmy Akin, thank you for 2 great hours of Bible study.
My pleasure.
That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.